I was born and raised in an Arizona where a middle-class family could buy their own home. And that should be the reality for the next generation, too. But to make it so, we must take action.
Welcome to the Political Notebook Podcast. I'm Billy Robb, a high school teacher. Here to talk with my dad, Robert Robb, who's writing on Substack, robertrobb.substack.com. Be linking to a couple of columns of his today, so check the show notes if you want to go visit those columns and subscribe. On this episode, that voice was Governor Katie Hobbs this year at the State of the State. We're going to talk about Governor Katie Hobbs, and also some of the dynamics going on at the state legislature this year. Last week, Governor Hobbs vetoed a bipartisan bill that was intended to boost the supply of housing in Arizona. She's taken some action on housing, but that was a huge action that was made rejecting an initiative to jumpstart housing. So we're going to talk about that. And I also want to talk about another topic, an important source of school funding, Prop 123, that's up for a legislative renewal, but it might be in danger politically. So I want to talk about both of those things. But to begin, I do want to just zoom out and start with a big picture question about the governor's overall performance so far. She campaigned on sanity over chaos, unity over division, and tackling the important challenges facing Arizona. So first question here is how do you assess her job performance so far? What kind of governor has she been, in your view?
I think it's difficult to assess her performance as governor because the Republicans in the legislature have been dedicated to undermining her ability to govern in ways that go way beyond the normal tension that occurs when one party has the executive and another party controls the legislature. That manifested itself most fully and vividly by the rejection of a large number of her appointees to run state government, the state agencies, and a failure to act on others. She has attempted to circumvent that by making them all deputy administrators. I think that creates a serious problem, potentially legally, for the upholding the validity of state agency action if those actions become legally challenged. So I don't know that she actually has been given a chance to govern because of the actions of the Republicans in the legislature. I do think she's missed a couple of opportunities to be the adult in the room. Consequentially, with what she has proposed for this year's budget. I give her a pass for signing on to the irresponsible budget that was passed last year, frittering away all of a $2 billion surplus. I don't think the Republicans in the legislature gave her any choice except to accept that or shut down state government. But given the fact that we have had a reduction in revenues and we're now facing fairly substantial deficits. I don't think that she offered a sensible governing budget for this year. She balanced her budget by doing things like kicking 50,000 kids off of the voucher program that the legislature would never accept, which rendered her budget proposal irrelevant and it continues to be irrelevant. If she had done something within the ambit of political possibilities, I think she could have set the table for the budget and largely gotten her way on it. But since she started so far afield of what was politically possible, we are, according to reports, nowhere on the state budget, despite facing a fairly yawning deficit.
Is that her responsibility to, and you think she's fairly criticized for not being more assertive on that stuff? I know last year's budget negotiations, she was criticized by Democrats for not negotiating a little bit more, I don't know, harshly or more tough, I guess, in trying to get some of the things that Democrats were wanting. The Democrats eventually came along with it, but there was criticisms there. Another common criticism you hear is that, well, what, maybe she's definitely achieved the sanity over chaos compared to who she was running against. But what are her proactive sort of goals on big issues? Is the budget process right now, how it's a little bit stalled? Is that on her?
It's certainly in part on her. I think that she, well, backing up, what the Democrats criticized her on last year was for not fighting harder for what is politically unachievable, which is substantial reforms to the voucher program, which, irrespective of whether you think they're warranted or not, the Republicans in the legislature are never going to go for it and would be willing to shut down state government over it. So, as I say, I give her a pass for what happened last year, including from the criticisms that she received from Democrats. Not this year. She began with a politically infeasible budget that, rather than creating a responsible, pragmatic blueprint for how to manage these big deficits, it was pie in the sky and is completely irrelevant. Reports are that she's not participating, and her staff is not participating in budget deliberations and negotiations. So I do think that her handling of the budget this year, as opposed to last year, is fairly subject to criticism from all perspectives. She started out by checking out with an politically unrealistic budget, and she's not engaged since then.
Do you think she's gaining allies in the business community? I know that one of the complaints that Republicans had is kind of targeting her over the Arizona Commerce Authority, I know that you maybe see more eye to eye with the MAGA Republicans on this issue, but is she gaining as she's maybe not fighting for some of the liberal things? I know you had called her more maybe trying to triangulate. Is she doing that effectively? Is she bringing the business community along in any perceptible way on her side?
I think that the fight over the reauthorization of the Arizona Commerce Authority has gained her support in the business community. That if a MAGA Republican runs against her, when she runs for re-election, I think she's likely to get a reasonable degree of business community support. The MAGA Republicans are steadily alienating the business community. I do believe that with respect to the incentives that are part of the current Arizona Commerce Authority structure, the MAGA Republicans are correct that those should go away. But you do need to have some entity that works with businesses that want to relocate to Arizona or current businesses that want to expand. And generally, the existing staff at the Arizona Commerce Authority are given very high marks for how they manage that. The MAGA Republican proposal by Jake Hoffman is to abolish the agency and divide those functions, scatter them elsewhere in state government. I don't think that's the most prudent course of action. I think you reauthorize the folks that currently are considered doing a very, very good job on recruitment and shepherding businesses through the expansion and relocation process, and get rid of the troublesome incentives that may have some constitutional flaws in any event.
Well, knock on wood, hopefully by 2026, a rational Republican or more, maybe that'll be the rise of the traditional conservatives by then. We'll see. Well, let's transition and talk about this housing bill, the Starter Home Act. You wrote a column about it today, recording on Wednesday, March 27th. It's a question about how to increase housing supply and what is the proper way to bring prices down and make housing more affordable. And this is interesting because it's an issue that's being discussed and fought over across the country. It's often portrayed as a battle of the NIMBYs versus the YIMBYs. The NIMBYs being the not in my backyard group. They want more restrictions on building and construction. And the YIMBYs, the yes in my backyard, want to open up all kinds of construction and build. And even Joe Biden's has been saying on one of his campaign pitches lately, he says, we got to build to boost supply and bring housing down. But the partisan mix is weird. It's scrambled. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, there's no pattern really to which Republicans support this act and which Democrats did. And nationally, there's also an article in the Dispatch today arguing that YIMBYs had the momentum and getting some policy wins across the country. But that momentum was halted here in Arizona. The Starter Home Act was passed on a bipartisan basis, but vetoed by Governor Hobbs last week. The premise of the bill is that you can't really build starter homes anymore because of all the zoning requirements that are set at the city level. So the clip that I started with in the beginning was Governor Hobbs saying that, you know, in the old days we used to have more affordable housing and now we don't. She wasn't specifically referring to zoning reform in that clip. She was arguing for like mortgage assistance. But was it easier to build starter homes back in the day? These zoning requirements, things like you have to have minimum lot size and minimum house specifications, for example, are these relatively new phenomenon that we have now?
They're not new, but they've become more burdensome and restrictive over the last two decades or so. The home that you grew up in could not be built today. The home that I'm currently living in could not be built today under the requirements. And probably, I would suspect, close to half of the homes that people are currently living in could not be built today as requirements for design features and lot sizes and lot coverages have accumulated over time. And the Arizona Starter Homes Act would have limited the ability of cities to place those requirements. It was really a remarkable political consensus that developed that concluded, including a majority of Democrats, that we need to free up the market in order to address housing availability and affordability. That's a remarkable consensus. Hobbs vetoed the bill, but a lot of Democrats in the legislature kicked back against her doing that. So I think that that's an enduring political consensus in the legislature. What the column analyzes what Hobbs proposes instead, and points out, in my view, the inadequacy of those things, that that's just nibbling around the edges of the problem. Basically, she's celebrating a variety of government housing subsidy programs that she has championed. And you simply aren't going to create broad-scale relief unless you free up the market. And having a majority of Democrats in the legislature reach that conclusion and vote for a bill that would do that, despite the fierce lobbying of local municipalities, is a remarkable political development.
Yeah, why do you think this issue is so weird politically? Because, you know, you had, it seemed like you had MAGA Republicans on both sides of it. Like you had some MAGA populists supporting it, some not, some more traditional Republicans supporting it, not, and then a mixture of Democrats. What is it about this issue that caused it to be so scrambled, do you think?
Well, the Republican opposition, I think, was motivated primarily by a desire to protect existing upper middle class neighborhoods. I think that that concern was misplaced because most of those neighborhoods have deed restrictions that cannot be overridden by legislation. And so the design and usage standards in those deed restrictions would continue. But I think that was primarily, if you look at Republicans who voted against it, I think that was primarily the motivation. Although it's worth noting that a majority of Republicans also supported the bill. For Democrats, it was a critical mass, a majority, concluding that freeing up the market is the only thing that will move the needle on affordability and availability in any kind of meaningful way. It was a on the policy, and they studied it. I mean, this is something that has percolated for 2 to 3 years. This is not a knee-jerk reaction or in a something that hasn't been deliberated on and carefully considered. The reaction to her veto indicates that it has deep roots within the Democratic caucuses, that they are convinced that you got to free the market in order to do anything meaningfully.
So here are some of the, there's like a list of some of the arguments that are against it. First, you hear, and some of the city mayors were making this argument that it's just greedy developers wanting to make more money, trying to pit it as the developers against the cities, and there's nothing in the bill that specifically pushes them to build more affordable homes. That was one argument. Another argument is that just about local control, right? That the power to control what gets built in your area should be up to the localities. The municipalities should have freedom to decide what's built there. I think there's another part of it that's maybe a little bit of fear of change. You know, this idea of, oh, it's just an experiment. We don't know what's going to happen, and we're not ready to go that far. It seemed like maybe where Hobbs was, although the city lobby is also very strong. So do you see what needs to, I guess the only thing that needs to break through now is a Hobbs changing her mind. But how does this bill make a comeback? I mean, like the tamale bill, it seemed like it's making a comeback this year for some reason. Hobbs has seemed like she's going to pass that bill. Is the argument need to improve? Then do they need to negotiate with the city lobby? Does there need to be some halfway point there? Or what's the pathway, do you think, to getting this kind of robust bill actually signed into law?
I don't think there's a possible compromise with the municipalities. They do believe that it's a matter of local control. They need to control it. Their argument about developers being set free kind of ignores the fact that developers are only going to develop homes that people want to buy. So they're not going to bring to market a product that nobody wants or that people don't prefer to the status quo. You know, the status quo will still be available. So it is, if you free up the market, you don't know what you're going to get. I mean, markets are constantly changing. I call them continuous experiment in the column because you never reach a final point. But we have upper middle class neighborhoods being built and homes being sold. What we have lost in the valley are single family neighborhoods for lower middle class and middle class families. And there's little reason to believe, since that's an unserved part of the market, that if the restrictions that make it difficult to bring that product to market are lifted, that we won't see a reasonably robust development of new product that goes there. I've talked to people in the industry, and in addition to my focus on traditional single family homes for lower middle class and middle class families, I'm told that there is a significant market for just smaller homes with little outside maintenance by both young singles, young couples, and retired couples. They call it a lock and leave product, where people who want to travel but don't want to live in apartments or condos, they want a standalone single family home. You can't bring that product to market. So I think that there is ample reason for the Democrats in the legislature and the Republicans to conclude that if we freed up the market, we would get a different kind of product that would serve those parts of the market that currently there's difficulty in bringing product to market for them.
Yeah, and you also made a good point in the column about how that freeing up of new kinds of housing would alleviate prices across different types of housing, including apartment renting, because if you have a lot of people that are living in apartments that would prefer to be owning their own home, but there's just not a home that they can buy, you know, that has a downward effect on the prices of and the demand for, you know, apartment rentals as well. So we'll see what happens on that issue down the road. A link to the column here in the show notes. One more topic I want to touch on here is Prop 123, which is a school funding mechanism, and you wrote about it a month ago. It draws money out of the state land trust. In 2016, voters approved a mechanism to increase the draw from the land trust from 2.5% to 6.9%. But that was for 10 years. And it's hard to believe that those 10 years are almost up. And so your column was partly a history of the trust and its distribution to schools, but it was also a warning that the politics aren't lining up very well to get Prop 123 renewed. Because nobody's really advocating for an extension of what it is right now. House Republicans want to keep the draw at 6.9%, but they want to make a change to how it's distributed. They want to make, you want to earmark a big chunk of it for teacher pay. And Governor Hobbs wants to increase the draw up to 8.9% and create three buckets of earmarks. So you called it a train wreck waiting to happen because it needs widespread support to pass, but it's not really getting widespread support. Has anything changed since last month, or should schools start preparing for maybe some budget cuts down the road?
I know of no ongoing negotiations or efforts to try to reconcile the position of Republicans in the legislature and the position of Governor Hobbs. That doesn't mean that it isn't ongoing. I just am not aware of it, and certainly there's been no reporting on it. This is another case where I would fault Hobbs's leadership for rather than going with something that is within the realm of political possibilities. I think that her proposal is just sort of a show, political posturing proposal. There are legitimate concerns about the extent to which a 6.9% draw affects the integrity of the corpus going forward, that there's some legitimate concern. I have said that I thought that that number is justifiable and should be made permanent. But going to 8.9% clearly draws down on the corpus, which isn't what a trustee, and this is a trust, is supposed to do. And then both proposals include a 4% bucket from the distribution. The legislature would devote that entirely to teacher pay. Hobbs has the same size bucket, but in addition to teachers, she includes other educational professionals, such as school counselors, librarians, and the like. So she's actually, even though she's proposing a higher draw, she's proposing less for teachers. I'm opposed to earmarks, period. I think you, in the competitive market, you distribute the money to the schools, you allow the schools to decide how to use it, and have the schools compete for students based upon how wisely they invest the resources that they have been given. But if it's going to be a bidding war, why politically would you start out with something that gives teachers less than what the Republicans are proposing?
Yeah, and right now
it baffles me.
So right now it all goes into the general fund, correct?
It goes to schools, so it goes to
the
general budget of the schools.
But they can use it however they want.
Correct.
Right, and it's about it's about $300 million a year in total.
Somewhere in that range. It's hundreds of millions of dollars.
And if it doesn't pass, then it reverts back to the 2.5% that it was before.
Correct.
And it's also a little more complicated because whatever gets passed here also needs to get passed through the U.S. Congress because it involves a state land trust that was set up by the federal government. So this is another reason why it's very important, right, to have widespread support and bipartisan support first to get it passed, the extension passed through the voters in an election where it's going to be, there's a ton going on in the 2024 election in November. And then plus you need to have the, first of all, the legislative skill and will to actually get it passed through Congress.
And I think it's easier to pass through Congress the simpler it is. If it was simply a continuation of what's existed for the last 10 years, and I would argue make that permanent rather than extend it for another 10 years, that's much easier to kind of sneak through Congress as a writer to some other legislation that's moving. And it would not be a bad move to try to get that done while Kyrsten Sinema, who's the most effective legislator in the Arizona congressional delegation, is still at the job.
Yeah, I was looking. One thing that's a little bit weird about this is, you know, I haven't seen any reporting on it last month, and I don't see the education groups really saying anything about it. Like the normal education advocacy groups aren't really talking about it. I think everyone's worried about, you know, the ESA rules and arguing about ESAs. And this seems like this is just totally flying on the, under the radar here. So,
well, the Arizona Education Association and most Democrats swung strongly behind Hobbs's proposal. The other education organizations need to mount an aggressive lobbying effort to get something on the ballot and something that has a chance of passing. I think there's a possibility that unless there's some Republican who's willing to dig in his or her heels, that at the end of the day, the Republicans in the legislature just put their thing on the ballot.
So they can do that without Hobbs's signature, right? Republicans Correct. Can. And for Hobbs's plan, they would need, I mean, they would have to all agree on that, which is probably not going to happen.
Right.
So, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Yeah, I think your conclusion too is like we should just probably make this permanent because we can't really trust the we can't really trust that this thing can get renewed every time, right? Like it might not get renewed this time.
I don't think there's any policy reason for it. I'm comfortable with the 6.9% as a permanent figure. If people are uncomfortable with that, then picking another permanent figure should be the option that is chosen. There's just no reason to go through this every 10 years. The same formula existed from statehood until 1999. So this switching the formulas and going back and forth is a very much a new and undesirable trend. We know enough, we have enough experience to pick a number and stick with it, and then change that number if circumstances suggest that in the future. Don't automatically terminate it and put educators into this seesaw as to whether they're going to get hundreds of millions of dollars or not.
Yeah. Well, all right. We'll see what happens with that. We'll leave it there for today. Last question. How did you make a March Madness bracket? And if you did, who'd you pick to win?
I, as you would know, did not make a bracket because I don't follow college basketball hardly at all. I did watch Grand Canyon University, from which your mother graduated, in its two games. So that was sort of the end of my March Madness trek. What about you?
It's in Glendale this year. The Final Four is in Glendale this year. No, I picked Houston to win it all, but they had a scary game in overtime. So I don't know if they're going to – I didn't watch any games during the year this year, any college games, but I've been watching a lot of the tournament games. I like the college game, I think, better than the pros lately. I think the refs do a better job of making it consistent. And I think just the game is strategically a little bit more fun. Suns, I'm not sure if they're going to get – I'm not even sure if they're going to make the playoffs this year, but hopefully they will. Anyways, thanks, everyone, for listening to the Political Notebook podcast. You can subscribe on any podcasting app that you listen to. Thank you.